Welcome to the Space Cave. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving break, or at least a long weekend. If you don't buy into that holiday for any number of reasons, that's understandable. But I hope you got together with some people that you care about and shared some laughs, ate some good food, and perhaps even tried some different beers or ciders. Like this episode is more of the pear cider from Sonoma, the Pitchfork. I was in Duluth for the weekend, which I'm always kind of hard on it because it's so relentlessly cold, but it is beautiful. If you haven't been up to those parts, the bridge, the ships coming in, the ice, it can be pretty. I hiked along a lot of parts of some land. I saw a creek. I went out around kind of the bay. Lots of cool spots in Duluth, and perhaps I'll share some photos. Highly unlikely, but you never know. And at the tail end, I stayed an extra night in Minnesota and opened for Chad Daniels at the Woman's Club in Minneapolis. So if you happen to be at that show, I hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was really fun and great to see, someone that I've watched do comedy for a long time jump up to kind of another level and go from a club to a really cool theater with a mezzanine, kind of a balcony in the top. It was really great, really fun to perform in. And anyway, but you didn't come here to hear about that. You came for part two of a terrific chat. I've really enjoyed this one and hope to have him back in. He's a writer for Bill Nye Saves the World, season two, coming to Netflix sooner or later. I don't know when exactly. I'll post that when it does. And talking a little bit about just life in general and his life prior to that job and a number of things. Just a fascinating, genuinely delightful fellow. I hope you enjoyed part one. And here's part two with Sandon Totten.
So that was a really short fellowship, by the way. It was only a week.
But you're at Oberlin.
No, this was – so I graduated from Oberlin. And like I said, I wanted to go into radio. So I found an internship in radio, and I worked way past the internship, just kept working, you know, doing stuff on the side and for free and probably illegally. You know, I shouldn't have gotten paid or something, and eventually got a job in Minnesota public radio. I'd worked there for a number of years helping do, you know, various shows and podcasts and stuff, and then got offered a job in Los Angeles. My first this was a real big news program they were launching in the mornings on a major station, and I was like, oh, I got to take it. And it was when I was there, I had started just kind of doing, since I had this psychology background and I had, you know, done a bunch of other science as part of that just for fun while I was at college, I had a decent understanding of some cool things in science. And so when I was pitching stories a lot, I would go to science because, you know, I was a journalist who didn't know a lot about news. I never read newspapers as a kid. I didn't understand politics. I didn't really I was never in wrote for the school paper. So when I was sitting at pitch meetings for my news program and everyone was talking about something in Syria or this new thing at the LA City Council or this or that, I had nothing to pitch, but I knew science really well. So I would just start pitching science stories, and those would get on the air a lot. And so I was doing enough of those that at some point someone had told me about this MIT fellowship where they pair you up with researchers and statisticians, and they basically teach you a little bit about how to be a better science reporter. And I don't know how I got accepted, and it was amazing. They'd send you out to MIT for a week, and I think it's called the Knight Science Fellowship. They pay for you to stay in a cool hotel. You meet all these cool people at MIT. They give you a tour of their media lab. You meet a robot or two.
Nice.
And we learned a lot of really important stuff. And this one was geared towards medical reporting, but I learned all this amazing stuff that to this day I still think about, like how many times you see studies that are sort of not studies, but the way people report them that are flawed. Like, you know, just the other day there was one about just the other day, there was one about alcohol increasing your chance of cancer like 500% or something. Mm-hmm. There was this like big headline that NBC News or someplace had put out. And what was interesting about it, you know, is that they don't say 500% of what. You know, if there was like, if these were like rare, you know, neck and throat cancers that maybe 1 in 7 million people get, you know, the increase might not be that large.
Yeah.
Or and maybe, you know, so the one thing we learned in this class was a lot about thinking different ways to quantify this. So, you know, one way is relative risk. So if you have, you know, a risk of, say, 0.1 is like the average risk of getting this kind of cancer, this might only make it like 0.04 more than you would have. But also aging might add to that, you know, maybe more significantly.
Yeah.
Another way is like that you don't often see in science reporting or medical reporting, but describing like how many people would it take for this to happen. So, you know, again, the cancer link with alcohol, I think there was a lot of talk about breast cancer, maybe like it increasing breast cancer chances. But if you look at the, you know, the statistics might seem scary, like, you know, they saw like a 40% increase or something. But if you look at it in terms of harm done to individuals, I think the number was something like it took 1,600 people would not get breast cancer, and then one would if they were all drinking a moderate amount of alcohol, you know, women in their 40s or something. So still a risk worth knowing about, but this is like it helps you in some ways process it, you know, in a way that you can say, well, yeah, I think I would be one of the 1,600 that didn't get it. So I think I'm willing to take that chance. Whereas, you know, some of these headlines that just say 40% increase or, you know, 500 times more likely or whatever, when you don't know the relative numbers or how that plays out in the real world, can be really harmful. So a lot of that stuff informed this idea that, you know, even in science and understanding information, there was sort of different levels to sort of doing it honestly and ethically. And I do think there's a little bit of punk in that, you know, you kind of want in some ways to challenge like, hey, just don't accept the status quo. Really dig, you know, think about it. How significant was that finding? How many studies backed that up? You know, just to question everything. There's an element of that that I think good science journalists do. And then I think there's back patches on every punk, you know, jacket out there that say question everything. So there's a little harmony there, even if there's none in the music.
Is harmony of music frowned upon in
the
No,
scene? It's totally not, no. Listen to Bad Religion. They have like these awesome three-part harmonies.
Yeah, yeah. And I kept wanting to say Alkaline Trio. Pennywise, they did some like harmony.
Yeah, No Effects.
Yeah,
harmonies.
Okay. No, I like that, I mean, we're bombarded with facts and data all day, every day. Everyone trying to back up their own point. You don't know where they're sourced from.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this feeling of like, how can you just thin it down to like, what are, even if you just had five of them, five things that you knew for certain, like this is never going to change. This is the world. It's hard to even pick one of those.
Oh my, wow, dude, you just like blew my mind, because I don't even know if I could pick. Like, I feel like as a journalist, you're taught to always look at the gray and the shades of uncertainty. And I really would have trouble picking five things that I would unqualifiably say, you know, in a tweet that this is 100% true. I mean, I probably could think of some, but man, that would be stressful, you know?
It seems like it, yeah. And it's one of those where like, that is the amount of things we know, you know, it's like when someone comes up to you and says like, tell me one good thing to you that happened this last week. And most people go, you just start digging like, I know things happen. What was one good one? And that's one with like, tell me, I think there's a Kurt Vonnegut thing. Maybe it's in the book with Ice Nine where he says to this woman, tell me one thing that's true. And she's like, God is love. And he's like, what's God? What's love? And like that's a little like, it seems to me like a snarky kid having an argument where you're like, all right, give me something here. But I do like that like just picking apart like these things you think you know, how do you really know them? And I mean, gravity starts to become one of those.
Dude, gravity is like, I mean, we talk about it like it's a given, but when I'm not doing science reporting, I work on a science podcast for kids.
Nice.
We take kids' questions about the world. We get it answered. It's called Brains On. It's my favorite thing in the world to work on. But we did an episode about gravity, and there was a point when we were really trying to, you know, every episode we try to really dig into the very fundamentals of what's going on in something, down to the particles and molecules. And I remember we were talking to this researcher about gravity, and at some point she or he, I can't remember who it was basically like, yeah, we still don't quite understand why. Like, we know how it works, we have all this evidence, but like there's a lot about it that's still kind of like a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fundamental law at some point that you just have to sort of be like, that's the way it is. We haven't, we don't know exactly what's going on these molecular levels to create this giant force when you aggregate a bunch of mass or whatever it is. So gravity, man.
I think the probably the more punk thing, or the more logical, or I think the reason people are drawn to science is its openness to say, we don't know, or we'll probably get to it, or we may never know. And I'm guilty of this. The lack of knowing makes people go, and people say, oh, it's a logical fallacy or whatever. But like, I do kind of think sometimes those things lead to like, maybe there is a God, or maybe there's something that went,
oh, yeah,
that's close enough. And true hard science is like, there may be, but this isn't enough evidence to say that it is.
Yeah.
Let's keep looking and we'll probably figure out what gravity is. But what if it flips us completely over in a way where we're like, that's what it is?
Yeah, this is something I struggle with a lot, thinking about where do you draw those lines on what you know for certain, and also being open to the idea that there may be total blind sides in your cognition, like we were talking before. But I also think there's something about, you know, when I first started getting interested in reporting on science, this was the early 2000s, and this was a time in which a lot of newspapers were cutting their science reporters. And mm-hmm. so it was kind of a novel thing that I was doing this, which was part of how I think I got ahead, because I wasn't the best, I wasn't the most experienced, but not a lot of people were doing it. So there was a little bit of a niche there I could get, because all the pros weren't getting paid to do it. And it became more and more in fashion after that. Like, it's sort of, there was a slow creep in the internet where people started looking at science and being really interested in that as a way to explain the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in that period, it also turned into kind of like, I mean, you see these GIFs that are like, because science, and
yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's just science, bro. Do you even science? And it became almost as if people were saying these were all hard facts, and it became almost like an identity politics thing. And I think this is the thing that's been getting me lately, is I feel like we're getting into an era now where science is almost seen as something that's, or at least one, I think there are people out there who feel like there's one group that lords that over them. We've got science and proof, and so whatever you say, I'll throw these stats at you and make you feel dumb because you don't get it, and make you feel like you're just wrong because I've studied it more and looked at all these things. And I think there's something really dangerous to that. And I don't think that that's, like you were saying, I don't think that's how science sees itself, is always understanding the truth. But I think we've kind of, in our love and excitement and maybe eagerness to look at science as a way to explain the world, might be coming off to a large part of the population as sort of, you know, daddy knows best. Here's the facts, you know?
I totally agree with that. It does start to become this, you can identify with it. You can start to, you want to have a team to be on and root for. And when you have one that has conclusive numbers that check out and things where you can present data, as opposed to like, oh, really? He walked on water? Where's your proof? And you know, so then you have these two like warring sides. And not to get too political, but I think where the punk thing ties in and the lack of wanting to identify with things, it's bothersome that you're either that, you're the science side, or you're this side, or you're on the left or the right. And if I'm honest, I probably align more with left type things. I think a woman should be allowed to choose. I think, you know, the trickle-down economics never really seems to work, et cetera. But I think then punks would also be like, yeah, but I don't love big government. Who loves big government? So there are these middle ground areas where people can be like, I don't see why you have to be fully left, fully right, fully science, fully this. Like, everyone probably has some middle ground. We're so far from finding that. And it does bother me to see the science side start to separate with those things you're talking about, that makes it very much like, just do the work. Just learn the stuff.
Yeah.
It'll present itself. You don't have to slam it in people's faces and make them feel dumb.
I don't know if there was another choice. I think about this because it seems like for a long time, science just did the work. And people said it was in an ivory tower, or they weren't doing enough to sort of tell people about the cool things they're discovering, getting people involved, or you know, sharing the really relevant facts. Like, a lot of people said science didn't do a good enough job early on warning about climate change, you know, that they were just sort of, the research will show, but they didn't go and evangelize about it. They didn't really. And then eventually a lot of, like, you know, I think in the last 10 years, a lot of scientists have learned to do that. And now it's a big thing. When I get invited to colleges sometimes to give talks on science communication, because people want to know more about, you know, people with PhDs and like much smarter than me who are like actually doing the work want to know, how do I present this in a way that's going to be interesting and make people understand it? So there, we are sort of moving into that world and not just doing the work. But I think that somehow is also translated to sort of science being an identity that some people take on.
Yeah.
And like you said, other people feel like that's an identity that they're excluded from, and then they sort of otherize science. And we've almost gotten to a world where now some people can say, well, that's your opinion about science. And I don't know how that happened. And it's crazy, because I feel like the whole point of science was that we would say, like, the whole reason, you know, when a lot of these people are developing these rules for the scientific method, and we all agreed that this is how we're going to do it, is because we wanted to have something we could all say, this is not opinion. Mm-hmm. This is as close as we can get to a fact. And we somehow botched it. There are certainly flaws in the scientific method, but I think it has more to do with what you were saying about, like, we can't always understand our motivations. And I think there's this in-group, out-group, like, thing that people fall into that trumps their own ability to see what I think is a beautiful machine for weeding out bad information, which is science.
Yeah. I mean, Allie, who was just on the show, Allie Ward, Cara Santamaria, there've been a number of people that are identify as like a science communicator. And I think that in talking with them about that, that idea of like the ivory tower and making it more accessible, I think there's such value in that. And that I look at it like you're talking about, like the people getting carried away with it. Like if you're a kid, and this probably isn't the best analogy, but like when you're a kid and one kid has like, did you have horny toads in the Midwest? You know what I'm talking about?
I know what a horny toad is, but I've seen one. I'm just like, you know.
So we had them in the desert.
It has the word horny in them. You know, you look them up.
They're so hard to spot. You like walk right past them and then like, wait a second, that's not a rock. And then they're really easy to catch. They're not a very fast lizard. And I don't even know if this story in its exact sense happened, but I do – like this analogy makes sense to me in that like you get – most people gathered around the box. It has some holes poked in it and they can look in and be like, oh, that's a horny toad. That's pretty cool. You got to give it a little bit of lettuce. If you find some ants, they might eat the ants, but like leave it alone. But someone will come look at it and be like, you got a horny toad. They're real. I want to show everyone because people weren't believing me. And they run around and the box is shaking and the rocks are flying around in there. And the horny toad gets really stressed out. And then everyone who'd been around it had been telling that, like, just relax, don't do it. But they couldn't help themselves, and they were so excited to prove it, to show it, to put it right in everyone's face, that then the horny toad, like, it ends up getting so stressed out, it stops eating, and then it just died. And that's not the best analogy, is like, that's what's going to happen with science. But I think that instinct in people is very much there. I think it's the same thing of just like, you don't have to make a meme and share it and blast it at people and make them feel stupid. Like, science is fun. It's accessible. The first time someone tied up a balloon and was like, the gas in here has a lighter density and it's going to float up. Do you believe me? And they go, no way. You added mass to it. It's going to drop. It's more dense now. And then they let it go and it went up. People must have been losing their minds.
Yeah.
Like running around going like, oh my God, you're not going to believe this thing. This guy predicted it. And then he just very calmly showed us. And now I'm telling you, look how excited I am. That feeling is the best. And
that
I think science
is awesome.
Still does that all the time.
Yeah. Wow. I really love that horny toad story, by the way. No, I mean, I think it's great. It reminds me of King Kong. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if this was in the original, but the Peter Jackson remake, Jack Black's character at the end says something like, you know, we always kill the things we love the most or something like that,
mm-hmm.
As like, you know, a very literal thing about how King Kong is dead. But
I should have just used that analogy.
No, I love it with the horny toad thing because I think you're right. There is this sort of exuberance we can sometimes have because I'm not trying to like poo-poo on people who, you know, really loves to blast out info on science and are science communicators. I mean, I think I fall into that camp. I do it mm-hmm. all the time. But it wasn't until recently that I realized that how other people might see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was actually, I think it was working on the Bill Nye Saves the World TV show as a writer when I started reading all the comments from all these people who felt really, you know, like science wasn't their jam and that this was kind of in some ways like preaching against them. And I was like, that's so strange because we were trying to do this, you know, in a way that we thought it would be exciting for everyone, like that feeling you had. But there are people out there who feel alienated by science. And so something about the way we're communicating it is not working to reach everybody. And, you know, we are addressing that hopefully in season two of Bill Nye. We're trying to think about that and be aware of that. And I think about that all the time as somebody who works in kids podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we're doing these shows for kids, I'm thinking really consciously, like, how do we craft something so that these kids will always feel welcomed by science, always feel excited by the balloon going up when someone predicted it,
mm-hmm.
and feel like that they have 100% authority to enter that world, even if they don't understand something, and ask questions about it, and then get to the answer that they feel satisfied. Like, that makes sense to me. You know,
mm-hmm.
I want to leave that door open. I don't want it to become a political identity. And I don't know how we do that, but I think that's going to be the next challenge we face. We've made science cool, which is awesome. You know, like it's now like a trending topic. And like when NASA does something cool or SpaceX does something cool, people are all about it. But I think the next step is like, how do we make it really be not just for people who like, quote unquote, like science, but like that science is just everywhere. Like, you know what Marvel did with superheroes, where like you don't have to be a comic book nerd to go see Thor movies. It used to be that way, that you would only be into it if you were a comic book nerd. Now everybody is into it. We got to find a way to do that for science where it's just in the air. I mean, because it is the air.
I think it's coming. I mean, you see like interactions digitally, obviously, like for the most part, you can just kind of voyeur in on and watch. But sometimes the other side will be like, yeah, stupid, blah, 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 thermodynamics, da, 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 da. And like, oh, like we're a fairly knowledgeable species. It's just the morality within us that maybe will never go away. We're going to always find ways to be terrible to each other and take one another down and have differing platforms to say, like, your way of living your life is incorrect. And if someone says a woman should have to have a child under any circumstances, it's really tough with any level of science or logic or rationale to be like, I'd love to talk you out of that. Because if they won't, I mean, if they're set in that and they're whatever age, it's reasonable that they've thought about it enough times and or been attacked enough times. Mm-hmm. So they just develop that shell of like, well, now I'm definitely not changing.
Yeah. Which is actually, I mean, I think we're all guilty of that. You know, even those of us who sort of try to arm ourselves with facts, I think it's like, as an exercise, try spending some time pretending the opposite of what you believe is true and seeing if you what it's like to find information that backs that up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary. You feel dirty doing it because you're like, oh, I've always held this belief and it's so core to who I am that I don't think I should even be willing to question it.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what I think, you know, a good open-minded skeptic would want you to do. Every once in a while, refresh your questioning, you know, and look at it again. But it's hard to do. It's really hard to do. And to ask, you know, it's hard to do that for yourself, but I think you should do it before you ask other people too.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was so weird. This was only like a couple months ago. You remember when Tim Allen was catching heat because he had tweeted like, if we evolve from, I think he said monkeys,
yes.
why are there still monkeys? Which, well, it's chimps. But two, it was kind of sad to me that he's like 60 years old and just having that thought for the first time. That seemed a little embarrassing. But then beyond that, people attacked him. They just attacked him. But very few people were saying like common ancestor. They were just attacking him as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like the common ancestor thing is a relatively new defense to that thing that feels like it's an age-old question or argument. Maybe it's not. Maybe people really did start asking that. Like, why can't we go to the zoo and watch like a chimp be born that can suddenly stand up and walk around? That should be happening with regularity. So I get that. But like I had done some jokes 6 or 7 years ago that kind of started exactly from what you're talking about, of really trying to like think about it from the other side. And it does feel weird to be like put on the helmet of someone that whatever that other thing is, whatever it's like, I need to own 1,000 guns.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Who am I now?
I remember this was not too long ago when the Trump administration had first come in, and I was reporting on what the mood was in the climate change community before I think he had maybe taken office, but we had all heard a lot of the things he had said, including that climate change was a hoax perpetuated by China. And I think this was at the time too when we still sort of thought that he held one position.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot more worry that that was going to be the way things were going to be. And I remember I did a story where I interviewed a bunch of scientists, you know, who all were very firmly in the camp that climate change is very real and were concerned for these reasons. But I also was like, you know, and this was, I think, about funding. Like, what would it mean if they didn't get the same funding? There was some sort of someone who proposed cutting all these NASA projects that funded, you know, climate research. What would that mean if all that money went away? And I remember I was like, I should do due diligence. I should talk to somebody who actually would think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I interviewed all these scientists. So maybe I could find a scientist who says, well, there's better ways to spend the money or something like that. And I found this woman, Georgia Tech, I think it was, who, you know, she seems like she's very climate skeptic. And I'm not sure a lot, you know, I've read a lot of pieces of, you know, where people tear down her theories and arguments. But I also thought like this is kind of a budget story. And she thought that, you know, we spend way too much modeling the future, which is really hard to predict. We should spend more time studying the past or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm getting that right. But I got a lot of heat for that from some climate researchers who were like, you shouldn't even talk to people who deny this. And I'm like, she didn't deny climate in my story. I didn't like give her a platform to go on and on about how it's fake. I just was sort of, you know, but they're like, well, you know, the more press she gets, the better she's going to be at explaining these things and blah, blah. And I just was sort of like, wow, man, there's definitely this element in our own community where we don't want to, you know, we don't want to let I don't know, there is an us versus them, I think, within the science community too. Not to say that, like, I would want to give a platform to, you know, climate change deniers. I feel like there was a long time in journalism where there was that, you know, 50-50 split between, you know, when in reality it was like 909 to, you know, whatever, one. But I don't know. I think there is something worthwhile sometimes sort of thinking about the other side and what points they're trying to make, if only to understand where they're coming from so that maybe you can argue better next time to convince them, you know? Unless they're all getting paid by big oil and it's a big conspiracy. What
right.
can you do?
Yeah. What can you, then if you see them, yeah, put on their Exxon badge, like, damn it, I knew it. But if they're just some person that's maybe misguided, like there's this show called Forged in Fire where these gentlemen have a limited amount of time to take some bit of metal, put it in a forge, heat it up, and smash it into a functional knife blade and
wow.
make the most beautiful knives. It's like Chopped or one of those shows, except knives at the end.
Wow, what kind of metals do they use?
Oh, man, everything. They'll take, like, a lot of times they reveal it with, like, a tarp. So, like, today, gentlemen, you have – and every now and again there is a woman on it. But it's a lot of dudes. And they're very endearing because they're just genuinely nerdy and, like, I just like making knives. And, like, every now and again there's a person you'd be like, this guy's probably a Trump guy. But they're – because they like knives, you're like, seems like a, like there's something about this person that is enjoyable. There's very rarely a person on the show I'm like, I hate this dude. That's neither here nor there. But they, yeah, they would pull it back with a tarp and they're like, you got to use lawnmowers. And so they'll like take the blade and they'll make that.
Or oh, that's so cool.
It's really cool. They'll like, you got to take old shotguns.
Oh, and then, man.
It's really fun. And then that sometimes they'll make them make the handle out of like part of the stock of the gun or part of the lawnmower or part of the, you know, cars. They use all kinds of stuff. And they, so they, as metalsmiths, have to know what metal within that thing, car, you know, whatever else, can form a hard blade. So they have to know a little. They can't just grab, like, I think this will work. What I'm getting at is when they make the knife at the end, they go out and test it. Like, they get to go, they go out to a tree and they chop it. I'm like, yeah, I think it's good. And I think that's what science should be. When you are on the side of right, when you have the facts, or when you have data that, that cannot be penetrated by illogical ideas, you could have a flat earth person come on and just talk themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
And if they made compelling arguments, I think you have to hear those and go, man, maybe we've got it wrong.
Yeah.
But there's so many things you can look at and understand and intuitively know beyond just math modeling, like physically looking at, that I don't see why anyone would be like, don't give them a platform.
Yeah.
I get it with Nazis because they had their run.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to suddenly enlighten people.
Yeah. I don't know though, because there's something dangerous, I think, about I mean, you only have so much time in the world, you know, to debunk every claim. And in some ways, I do feel like, and I'm going back on what I said, because I also was like, you know, I felt like I was justified in having this person in my story. But then, you know, you can't go and debunk every claim because there will always be someone who can come up with something else. And it almost seems like there's an industry dedicated to coming up with counter theories and counter, you know, conspiracies about everything.
Yeah.
And the human imagination is vast.
Well, did you watch Westworld at all?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, like, they give them a game. They give them a pursuit, and everyone, it goes to that existential thing. Like, we, if you're convinced that the Illuminati is doing stuff or that they're a lizard people, that's a fun thing to burrow into, read a bunch of articles. If you're wearing a tin hat or you're not, like, your life is consumed by it. And that's fun because you don't have to get up every day and be like, what does all this mean?
Oh, man. Yeah, you're right.
So maybe that
you have, like, a meaning. That's yeah. I listened to this great podcast called Oh No, Ross and Carrie, plugging another podcast on your podcast. But they just interviewed a bunch of flat earthers, and it was interesting. You know, because you were mentioning trying to, you know, listen to the arguments. They listen very open mindedly to the flat earth arguments. They try really hard not to shoot them all down and let them kind of get to where they're going. But there was a lot of times where they mentioned that people just, you know, they didn't have an explanation other than the government has this big conspiracy because they're bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting to think that you could see the world so black and white.
Yeah.
But also then you're waking up with a real clear picture of what you're up against every day. Yeah. Because, like, I wake up and, you know, as a journalist and a reporter, I used to be more black and white as a punk. You know, I thought capitalism was evil, we'll smash the state, all will be good. You know, then I spent a lot of time in self-organizing anarchist communities and realized, like, wow, people are really bad at organizing. They have a lot of petty drama. Like, you could spend like 2 days arguing whether it's more economically better to buy, like, the, you know, toilet paper that's made from recycled trees, but it costs more, or buy the really cheap stuff and have more money for the revolution. You know, like, this was crazy, waste of time. And so I kind of, like, became really nuanced about government and politics in a way that I think a lot of my peers aren't, mm-hmm. where I often can see things from multiple perspectives or understand a little bit of why one thing works and one thing doesn't. Or I try really hard not to take a side so I can both remain neutral and also see where other people are coming from. But, you know, I forgot where I was going with this. What was my first point?
It was like the idea of giving a platform to people that maybe shouldn't.
Yeah.
And then you started talking about the woman...
It was all past that. Wherever I was going, basically, it's hard to figure it out.
Like,
man.
having a pursuit, like, is that what it was tying back to? The idea of having, like, you're driven to do this, and then so you're starting to identify with, like, the punk movement, but then seeing some of the cracks, the, not to say frailty, but some of the stuff you maybe believe in, looking around and being
Dave,
like...
David's just gone.
Damn.
It's just gone. I don't remember.
I was hot on its tail.
Yeah, I thought so, but, you know, it doesn't ring a bell. Anyway... It's tough, man. It's tough to find truth. And I think the more time you kind of look in the grays, the more everything looks kind of gray. Oh, that was it. So, yeah, these people wake up with black and white and they see the government as evil. And even though I spent so much time poo-pooing the government as a kid, I now look at it. I'm like, well, there's a lot of great things the government does. Mm-hmm. You know, I love roads. I love that they're paved. You know, they could be paved better, you know?
I'm glad the FBI is out there catching serial killers.
Yeah, I think, you know, public education's flawed, but like, man, what a kick-ass idea, you know? Mm-hmm. And I love to see it get better. So, I mean, yeah, I don't wake up with that sense of clarity of like knowing who my enemy is. And so instead I just think, you know, most people are probably my friend if I could just find a way to get to know them.
Oh man, that's romantic. That's the most positive thing anyone's ever said in here. Most people are my friend if I could get to know them. Do you do that with like, cause I've talked about this on here, like having a friend who was posting some very like anti one side stuff, which then aligned him with a side where I was like, that's not you. Like, I know this dude, very friendly with the LGBT community, et cetera. He's just an old dude that likes guns. And so I called him, we had a nice conversation and left feeling like, we know each other. Like, yes, he feels this way about this particular thing. And I think openly he said, like, I just felt like I was getting attacked by everyone all the time. And mm-hmm. that's why I started posting that stuff. I was like, I get it. You know, if you harbor this feeling and this fear that like you may be without the ability to own a gun and you've had one your whole life, you might start aligning with this side and maybe tuning out some of the other things that would otherwise be glaring red flags. I get that. Not to make like concessions for people that voted that way or whatever, but he is a friend of mine. And so I don't feel like he's my enemy or something like
yeah.
that. I just felt like,
is it like a friend from high school or a friend?
No, he's a dude that used to live across the street from my mother, and he's in his mid-70s, and I had a Labrador who was fairly rotund at the time, and he got stuck. Yeah, he was a husky fellow.
You don't want to hurt the Labrador's feelings.
And he was really hot, and we also had this dog that was kind of mixed with like a hound dog, and true to hound dog fashion, he would like burrow under the deck and just sleep under there, like just... playing like a little straw hanging out of his mouth. Sure, it's hot out there. And
your dog has the best accent.
Come on in this porch a bit. And so my dog saw him, must have seen him, and thought like, it's like 10 degrees cooler in there. I'm coming in.
What a genius.
And he started digging in, and he just got wedged and was like yelping and whining, and it was like 100 degrees. He certainly would have died. And the neighbor across the street like heard it, ran over there, tried to pull him out, too fat, too wedged, ran home, got a chainsaw, cut him out of the deck, and my dog lived.
Wow.
And so whatever he does in life, even if he openly planted flags in his yard for candidates that I thought were even worse than the current crop.
He saved dogs.
He saved my dog. He's a good guy.
Yeah. No, I do have friends like that, and I value that. And a lot of people have told me to unfollow certain people because, you know, they'll comment on threads sometimes making fun of something or, you know, being, you know, they when I talk to them, they usually think they were just joking around and people can't take a joke. And I get that. Like, humor is subjective.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, like their jokes, and sometimes I think they could be offensive, but I almost always message them privately and say, hey, why were you thinking? What were you doing? You know,
yeah.
What was that about? And it's funny how quickly we can get to a place of sort of common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, their persona they were playing was a lot more loud than they really are.
Yeah.
And there's certain issues we just totally diverge on. But it's a nice reminder that, you know, there's still somebody I like underneath all that politics. And like 90% of the things in the world we agree on. Like, we both love pizza. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we're still into, you know, some of the same bands. You know, we both agree that like, Mass Effect was a great series. You know, there's these common things, and it's just these, sometimes we get really, it's fun to argue.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
it gets your blood going, you know, talking about things you have in common. It's not as fun.
No.
Sometimes.
I mean, and then they reference that like in The Matrix. I think that's a fairly common thing people talk about, like the idea of utopia. Like, I don't think we would sustain it very well because we have to have our pursuits. We have to have differences and teams and ideologies that differ, and taking up a sword and, by God, if I die, I will have done something right.
Like, yeah.
And then what? The species will keep going and you'll be barely remembered throughout the little, you know, lineage that you were a part of.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you summed it up right there. That's a really good thing to think about. And I think, you know, with the kind of stuff you're trying to do, you know, bring science into a funny place and to poke holes in it and also like respect it. And I think humanizing, right? We're all humans. Humanizing this stuff is kind of what we all should be aiming for. And it is, we are just sort of like, you know, one moment in the stream of time. We mm-hmm. got to remember that. Try not to take that seriously, but also, you know, respect each other. Everyone's, you know, got more intelligence than you probably know. And Bill Nye says this all the time, and I think it's a really great thing. You know, everybody you meet knows something you don't know.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, he's right. And I think he tries to live that way. I've been trying to live that way more and just be open-minded to people. And, you know, I know sometimes it looks kind of ugly in the world right now, and there's a lot of fighting and there's a lot of bad things happening. And I won't deny that those are terrible things we're seeing in the world right now. But I don't think I could get up in the day if I didn't think that there was a solution to kind of getting us all on the same page. And mm-hmm. That's what makes me want to keep being in science, is that I think there is a way we can figure out how to explain all this stuff in a way that everybody someday will be cool with it.
I like it, man. I think it all, you know, the punk aesthetic is, I think it's so worthwhile because like there's a truth to it. There's a thing where like, this band isn't posturing. They're not bullshitting us. Mm. This is purely what they're doing. The way they tour, the way they've gone around, it's not sponsored by whoever. There's not some secret corporate money behind this. You can, for whatever reason, kind of trust it. And it seems like that's what you're kind of pursuing in getting to the root of like, here's what has been discovered. Here, this has yet to be co-opted or corrupted by, like, you know, when they find out, say, that sugar or sugar substitutes are creating tumors, mm-hmm. and then Coke does its own funding and says, like, show otherwise.
Right.
You know, those sort of things, when like, it takes people that do the journalism behind it to uncover that and expose it to the world. Like, here's what happened. I know everyone's been hearing this story. Here's who funded it. And here's what happened to those rats. And I like that. That feels very cool in punk rock.
That does sound cool.
Well, it sounds cool.
I would love
man.
To be doing that. Yeah. And I think that's something, you know, it's like what you're doing. I love power to the people. You know, I love, that's to me was a big thing about punk, was that it was do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could, if you wanted to start a band, you could start a band. If you wanted to start a fanzine, you could start a fanzine. If I started a record label in high school, like, who does that? We didn't sell any of them. I think they're all still in my friend John's basement.
But you were pressing them and like having meetings as an
A&R
actual guy?
Records. Yeah, we would go talk to a band. Like, we had this big, like, we're like this hot date. They could be like, do you want to be on our label? And they would all, you know, you're going to pay for me to get recorded? Sure. You're like, we'll do it. But that's the thing, is I want people to feel empowered, you know, to do good things in the world. And I like when we all feel like we're in charge and not corporate entities or larger, like sometimes institutions get carried away.
Yeah.
We're all, institutions are made of people, but you know, I really trust people. I trust individuals
yeah.
in a way that I don't trust institutions. I think that's a lot of where my punk ethos comes. And that's why I do want to talk to people who I disagree with. And I do want to hear their voices when I'm reporting. Cause in some ways, you know, I feel like more respect for someone when I put a face to them
yeah.
in that small venue, you know, when you're in a punk band and you're playing for 25 people and you know all of them, or you can see them all and they can all talk to you afterwards. There's something really honest in that to me, you know? And
oh, I think, man, I know a lot about performing to 25 or less people.
Exactly. And I think there's something good about that. And I think that's kind of how I want to live my life. And I want to deal with people. It's like, you know, 25 at a time or less, you know, where I can just,
I like it,
you know, look you in the eye and try to mm-hmm. get what you're about. And you can try to get what I'm about. And maybe we'll both come away, like, maybe not changing our mind, but being like, oh, I get someone from that side.
Yeah. I did a show in Topeka years ago, and driving in, it's exactly what you would think. That's like Fred Phelps territory and the Westboro gang and all that. And you drive in, it's like a lot of you're going to hell and abortion billboards everywhere. But the crowd at the club was really fun. And I was like, you guys are aware that like those billboards represent who everyone passing through here thinks all of you are as a town. They're like, yeah, but that's not us. And that's probably how we all kind of look politically at the elected leaders from certain areas. Like, well, that guy's your governor or senator or what. That's all of you. You all voted by a majority to let this jerk get in there. And people are like, that's not us.
Yeah.
And I try to keep that in mind, that like the internet is so terrible because it appeals to people that don't like being in public. But when you go in public, you're like, oh, we're all pretty good to each other. We're decent to one another.
We've made it work for quite a while. I mean, we have our flaws for sure, but you couldn't have built most of the stuff if we weren't at some point cooperating in some ways. Not always of our own will, sadly. I mean, it goes both ways. I had a lot of friends who were so liberal that, you know, it was really hard for other people to relate to them, and they seemed like a caricature. And, you know, you'd talk to them and you'd sort of figure out why they cared so much, but, you know, to the outside world, they were the person throwing cans of piss at, like, you know, the Republican National Convention bus as it tried to pull into the, you know, the meeting and stuff. And it just, yeah, I don't know, man. It's easier to see it in black and white than gray, but
you're in the gray world. Well, I have a few questions as far as that goes. Like, say it did get to a relatively dystopian place, or not dystopian, sorry, utopian place, where people were recognizing facts and data and had the unbelievable capacity to go, you have proven yourself accurate more so than you have proven me wrong, and I concede to you in this argument, this is our new society. And imagine living in that world, and now suddenly reason and rationale starts to trickle through all of society. Then what? Like, what would your ideal sort of economic structure be?
I mean, can you write that book? I want to read that book right now. Like, what are the cracks that happen when people suddenly think logically? I mean, this is probably like a Vulcan world, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it doesn't mean you have to – why are logic and emotion always cut out? They don't have to be cut out, right? I mean,
no, you can still feel things.
Yeah, so what would that world's problems be? I don't know, man.
Yeah, because it would fully change all of the need for different social programs, and then maybe that would – eliminate the need. Again, with rationale, you could look to
people
and be like,
GoFundMe for this book?
I gotta start writing it. Yeah, that would be kind of a fun novel where in the end people are like, you've made a good point. I guess I don't need to have $50 billion in the bank because people starve worldwide.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna change some of my tactics.
Exactly. Like a world in which people just like thought rationally all the time and like agreed with each other, and then like your protagonist would be somebody who just really hates everybody getting along and just like is frustrated by it but has no reason to because everything's working really well, and just like a completely ineffectual kind of like rebel. Just
I need something to be terribly wrong.
I mean, then would we stop playing fast loud music because we're just like, well, it's the point, there's nothing to get angry about.
Yeah, it's that Westworld thing. They designed this one pretty well. I mean, if you're discontent with it, then there's not much you can do. You just stand there and kind of go, I hope they change the model soon. And maybe they will. The people that root for doomsday things and build bunkers, they're waiting for the next upgrade in the game. Like, oh, here it comes. But hopefully you can get involved with Illuminati stuff or false flag things.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. But okay, here's a hypothetical question I've been asking recently. It has got no real – it's not a look into who you are at all, really. I'm just curious. Like, you have a button – and you can, by pushing it, eliminate humanity from the planet. They don't feel anything. If there's an afterlife, they go to it. Whatever's going to happen will happen. But they all go at the same time, and Earth is devoid of this chaos that is humanity. Would you push that button?
No way.
No chance at all.
No.
So I like to think about that, and well, I don't want to give too much away because I want to ask future guests as well. No one's said
yes
so far.
You're not going to answer it yourself, are you?
The thing I think it brings up is that, like, by agreeing that none of us, I don't think any of us would push the button.
Right.
And that there's something romantic about all of us going at once and not having to deal with grief and not having to deal with all the stuff. So by every day of us, like, saying essentially, I'm not pushing that button, we're buying into, like, this is what it is. It is that you have to kind of just accept it that, like, I won't push the button because I want to figure this out or see
where
it
goes. You're making a choice. You're making so, okay, this is your choice. What are you going to do about it?
Right.
Interesting.
I think it's marginally helpful.
It does give you like a little more agency, I think. It makes me feel like, okay, I'm buying into this. Mm-hmm. What am I going to do about it?
Yeah.
Here's a hypothetical question I love asking people. Okay. It's not nearly as profound. If you could, okay, it's a one or the other, okay? Option one, if you could spend 1 week camping in dinosaur times,
okay,
to pick which era, and you couldn't be killed by the dinosaurs. It's just you and like five of your friends. You get to bring like all the REI gear you want.
Ooh, okay.
And you just get to explore, have a good time, go back, you know, people won't believe you, but you could tell them about it, but you don't have phones or anything.
Yeah.
Just 1 week with your friends, Dinosaur Time Camping, or you could get 3 buttons that would allow you to reset time at any point up to, I don't know, a week. And you could use them anytime. So like if you just get hit by a car and you're about to die, you could hit it and go back, just avoid the accident.
Yeah.
If you watched a lottery that was like a $10 billion thing and you're like, oh, going to go back, I can just win all that money. Or if like you really mess it up with a girlfriend and you're like, I just need to go back. I think I could fix it. I really shouldn't have done X, Y, or Z. You could just hit the button, go back.
Yeah.
Try to fix it, everything. Which of the two would you pick?
Well, I'll explain my reasoning to some degree, because I think these bring up a lot of great there's a certain ideology, which I would imagine the punk aesthetic leans more toward one heavily, because the idea of winning the lottery speaks to the idea, like, if that's what matters in your life and that you knew that would truly bring you happiness, then you kind of have to go with that one, because any given week is a slice that you're saying won't match up to the long-term gain of being a lifetime lottery winner, meaning you could do anything. You could see this planet in its current form much more vastly than you could just the 1 week on the dinosaur world. So that would weigh into it, that feeling of like, I could be one of those people that had a private jet and flew everywhere, saw the inside of every volcano, the top of every mountain, saw the planet in its current state fully. But I still think I would choose the dinosaurs.
Yeah, most people do. And I think that's in some ways a safer choice. I feel like if I had the 3 buttons, I would be so paranoid that I would use them at the wrong time.
Yeah.
That I wouldn't use them. I would save them all to like my dying day and just like have like, oh man, I can relive my last week 3 times.
Well, man, if
because the
stress. I feel like that's very profound, because that speaks to the same thing. Like, you have the buttons. Technically, you choose your path going forward every day. And you're afraid to make choices currently. You're afraid to make decisions. Everyone deals with those. Like, what if I do this?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You really?
But on the other hand, you could do great good with it too. Like, imagine your ability to, I don't know, like, go back a week and really help warn people about Hurricane Harvey or something. Or like, you know, you're going to like actively get like a family that you hear about getting destroyed, just like get them out of the house. You're going to show up early. You're going to be there with the car. You're like, you could do that.
You could do one. As far as like a whole town evacuate, you can't even do that if you're showing waves crashing.
It's true. You're right. That might be a bad example, but there might be some moments in life where you really think one person could have made a difference. You could have stopped the shooter. You could have stopped the bomb or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what if that's happening all the time right now, though, and it's all these ones just get through the cracks?
Oh, that's amazing. No wonder we're so safe. It should be a lot more chaotic.
It should be constant just anarchy. Here's one I ask physicists sometimes. I don't know if you have any interest in this one, but it's pure white space around you, and you are – it's about the like circumference, and it doesn't have to be spherical, but it's – you're holding in your giant godlike hands the universe. What do you think it looks and feels like?
Slimy,
like
the slime the kids make. Not slimy, but like that, like gooey. You take borax and Jello, and I mean borax and Elmer's glue, and you mix it together, and it's kind of this like, it's a non-Newtonian fluid, to get physics here, where it's like if you squeeze it slowly, it's a liquid, but if you squeeze it hard, it kind of feels more solid. If you throw it against the wall, it smacks, but if you hold it in your hand, it oozes. I think that's what the universe feels like.
I like it.
Yeah, what about you?
That's the first one of those. I like to think of it as just this kind of like pulsating sort of almost like gaseous sort of thing. Like, you wouldn't even really feel it. Like, you would just kind of sense a density to it, but maybe not know where the actual edges or bounds of it was. I don't think it would have a skin or anything like that to firmly delineate where. But I don't know. I'd probably change that all the time. Change my thinking on that. But most physicists and people of that nature, when they hear it, go, I got to think about this more. Like, they almost can't answer right in the moment. And I like just the first thought. Like, what's your first thought when you think you're standing there holding it? There's too many
qualifiers.
There are too many things outside of it that I think a lot of times like a physicist's brain can't naturally just launch right to them.
Right, because there's no real answer.
Yeah, and I think the white space doesn't make sense to them. Like that gives bounds to something that we have no logical reason to think it in any way exists.
Here's another one. This was actually inspired by something Ali Ward said on your podcast a couple episodes back about the afterlife, where she would just have coolers full of LaCroix, which made me think. I think a lot about if like the afterlife is what I design. Like, I get my own sort of like personal, you know, if you do a good enough job, you go to somewhere and it's what you wanted. What would my afterlife look like? And what would I be able to do? And I wonder what's yours? What would you be able to do in your afterlife? What's your cooler full of LaCroix?
Yeah, good question. I I don't think I'd want to feel time. I'd never want to be like, it's almost this time yet. But I'd want to feel the feelings of what certain times of the day feel like. So I'd want to be like open space with a lot of animals around and hear like the wind blow through trees and see like a really pretty sunset. As cliche as that sounds, but like there is something about the sun kind of setting and giving a sense of like, we're closing in on the end of yet another day. Mm-hmm. That feeling of like, well, that's what I think I would want, that feeling. Like the way the air in the kind of like late summer feels on your skin, all that. I'd want all those feels, but I wouldn't want to feel the time in the same way.
Yeah, like that it's fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
How about you?
I've often felt like I would want to just be able to relive and quantify my life all over again. Because like I feel like I'm so – this is actually I think Nietzsche's idea for – what he thinks morality, why we should be moral. Like, what if you had to live your life all over again, but you couldn't change something? I might be botching this because I never really read much Nietzsche, but if you had to, like, if you were John Malkovich-ing your life and you were stuck in there and someone else was like, you know, you were just there as an observer and you had to go through it all again, mm-hmm. would you be cringing constantly because you were doing terrible things?
Yeah.
But I also think like, well, I've been trying really hard to live a good life. I try really hard. I don't always succeed, but I think I would love to be able to just go back and revisit my various moments in life in a quantifiable, like in different ways, like just go through all the kisses I've ever had. And then another day, just go through every time I got like tipsy on a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, another time go through like every Twinkie I ever ate, or like all the, you know, all the best desserts, or like, you know, every good walk, or like even just like, even try like, you know, the every time I like got a paper cut and just see like, just kind of feel the different things. And I'd also love to quantify everything in my life. Like I'd love to be able to walk into a room and every bowl of cereal I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
Every marshmallow, all the bugs I accidentally swallowed. I want to just go into a room at the end of my life and be like, that? I swallowed that? You know?
I used to think about all the things you're mentioning are like, oh man, I spent a lot. I feel like middle school was the prime period for me to think of all these things. I wanted to for sure know, like, right when I die, my shooting percentage into any hoop or receptacle of any sort. Here's what you shot for a lifetime.
You get like the stats of your life.
Yeah. And get those to relive certain moments, but you wouldn't get any insight as to what it was going to be. You're suddenly just in your shoes. And this was helpful when I was in middle school because I kind of had this vague feeling, and I for sure feel it now, which is if I was just in that position and I went, oh, this seems vaguely familiar. And you could recognize it, like, oh, right, at some point I walked over here. Yep, this is like the John Malkovich thing. But now you had the capacity to change it to like, oh, I always thought that if I did this, I could have kissed her, or that I could have saved that thing from falling over, or whatever.
That'd be fun to be able to just like play again certain levels.
Yeah, and just, oh, that thing that embarrassed me so much, if I could just relive that once more and be not even a hero, but just not such a doofus during it. And I'll bet you'd still screw him up a lot because it would take you a second to figure out where you were and what you were doing, unless it really, really mattered. Because then if you got in those moments, you'd be like, thank God I'm back here. I've been thinking about this my entire life. I want to remedy that.
Yeah.
That could be a close second for an afterlife.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember hearing an interview with somebody about a book that described the afterlife kind of the way I was describing it. I wish I could remember what that book was, because I'd like to like revisit that idea more. But I like the idea of like being able to do infinite do-overs just for funsies to see what would happen if you did like call out that one person with the joke you've been thinking of for 10 years that would have been better, or like if you just like decided to show up naked to school one day for real and just like what would happen. You'd be like, oh, I could just, you know, I could just stop this at any moment. This is all a big simulation.
I used to think like it would be so cool if the simulation had a finite number and you could process or experience in without just sitting there going, another one, I can't watch another one of these. But if you could just feel them all at once, like here's every death you just narrowly missed.
Ooh,
you know, like remember that day when you swerved right? Well, here in another life, that's where you died. Or in this day when you did this.
So see like every single parallel universe.
Yeah.
Like all the major hits. Not like everyone, because they're constantly happening, but just like the greatest hits of your parallel lives.
Yeah. Just the major. Yeah, the big plot points.
What if you did dye your hair blue, David? Like, what would that life have been like?
Because they say this in sports a lot. We're like, it's a game of inches, or like one play changes stuff. But sometimes you do watch a game and you're like, I know the score looks really lopsided, but it was just a couple little moves here and there. Mm-hmm. And what if that's all life is, where like we all, or anyone at any given time, like it, just these little moments, like you could have been at the top of your field or ultra wealthy or a totally different physical
like
thing.
Like a drug addict, like totally miserable.
Yeah.
That would have made me feel good if I was like, oh, I did a good job. Like I walked that knife's blade really well. I think if I saw like that I could have been the top of my field, like I would feel like pretty lousy about myself. I'd want to see all the ways I could have messed up.
That would be great if you finished at like a 23 and you could watch the 22 below you and be like, well, at least I did better than those 22. Or you finished at a 97, like, amazing. I walked that knife's blade and like all the other 96 died in gutters full of drugs.
Yeah.
And I made it out of
all the drugs and diseases just like pouring out of them.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well, here's to hoping that's what happens.
If
there's something, right? It'd be fun. I know in science there's a lot of like, there's no evidence. Like, come on. It's fun to entertain. I hope there's something.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what else is imagination for if not for thinking about what happens after you die?
Well, dude, I've probably taken up enough of your time.
Yeah, this is fun.
This is real fun, man. And the cider, great suggestion from what, the Pitchfork? Is that what it's called?
Sonoma Pear Cider. It's called the Pitchfork, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Certified organic. Man, you get me.
I didn't even see that. But I only drink organic cider.
Yeah.
Now, they're pretty good at the store of sourcing stuff that seems like it's relatively ethical. So anyway, I really enjoyed it. Sandin Totten, you're a delight. Come back anytime.
Thanks, David.
Well, he's a pretty good guy, that Sandin Totten. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope if you're into pear cider or cider in general, go give it a try. The Pitchfork. I found it to be pretty delightful. I'm not a big cider person, as you could probably tell by the show not having a ton of ciders on it. But that typically is just because of what people, say they request when I ask them what kind of beer they like. If you have a beer that you'd like to hear or share, you can send it to pings@thespacecave.com or tweet space_cave on Twitter. It's pretty easy to get in touch. Or if you're an expert or have a topic you'd like to potentially hear discussed, or any number of things, some gripes. If you've got some gripes, go ahead and send them over. Otherwise, if you want to support the show, you can always donate at thespacecave.com for just, hey, here's a couple bucks, go buy some beer and sit down and chat with somebody. Or if you'd like to be more of a monthly person, you can subscribe to the Patreon, where you get bonus episodes or you hear longer versions of some of the chats or calls, things like that. I also post some more, like these photos I mentioned. Maybe I'll post those on the Patreon. I don't know why. There's Instagram and things like that. I find it all overwhelming. You constantly have to be sharing your life. But I feel like having a podcast is a very, for me, it syncs up with, you can do it in a little bit longer form method. And, you know, it doesn't feel so, I don't know. I would imagine people that are good at it, like social media, are constantly thinking about it. Like, ooh, I got to post something. People are wondering what I'm up to. I'm never really wondering what they're up to. Sorry for whispering. That might have been creepy in your ears. Apologies for that. I don't think I've ever done that on this show. Let's get out of here. This is some music from Craft Spells. This is called Your Tomb. Hope you have a great week. Thanks for supporting the show. You guys are great. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.